Welcome to We Are Chafee's Looking Upstream, a conversational podcast of humanness, community, and well-being rooted in Chafee County, Colorado. I'm Adam Williams. Today I'm talking with Mating Patelis. Mating is a professional photographer and an entrepreneur. He's a ski instructor and a versatile mountain and endurance athlete. His upbringing in a Latvian family and community is really interesting to me. I come from a mixed European lineage that lacks clearly defined history and culture and sense of identity. So I'd love to learn from someone whose family roots run deep, and they came up with certain lessons and stories and a cultural identity that was being shared with them. That's the case for Mating. We talk about his Latvian roots that helped to shape him as a kid growing up in Kalamazoo, Michigan. We also talk about the value of community, not only in his Latvian upbringing, but in the years since. And we talk about community as one of the three essential elements that enhance all our lives. We also get into photography, including how Mating won his first camera, how he came to learn he has the eye, as they say, and about the realities of trying to make it as an adventure photographer. We even dip into the realm of AI and get Mating's thoughts on how artificial intelligence is factoring into photography these days. The Looking Upstream podcast is supported by Chafee County Public Health and the Chafee Housing Authority, and it's available on all podcast players and at wearechafee.org. The show also airs at 1 p.m. Tuesdays at KHEN 106.9 FM Community Radio in Salida. Show notes, including links and a full transcript of this and all Looking Upstream conversations, are available at wearechafee.org, and you can support the podcast by following We Are Chafee Pod on Instagram and through supportive reviews on Spotify and Apple. Those are helpful for spreading the good that we're trying to do here. Now off we go with Mating Patelis. Mating, there are many, many interesting things about you and your story, just from what I know about. I'm really excited to dig into a lot of this a little more. But where I want to start is with something that is especially unique to you in terms of podcast guests we have had here. And that is, when you were a child growing up, that Latvian call and response music was a thing for you. It was something of interest. I would love to know more about this.
Well, thanks for saying as much. I don't think we often get told that we're that interesting, but I appreciate it. Call and response singing. Yeah, so we grew up in the Latvian pagan church. And so it's actually called Dievturība, which is translated to God holders. And it's just like a very old Latvian religion. And my mom's dad, I think that's kind of like where it came from in our family. And he actually ran the church here in the United States for a really long time. And so we would go up to this place in Wisconsin where they just owned a piece of property and had I don't know, like a lodge type thing or whatever. And, yeah, we just grew up in that space. And a lot of that, kind of, old school Latvian to me, really, I'm like, it's, you know, it's that farmer kind of, agrarian society in Latvia. And so it was just a lot of farm work. And, like a lot of cultures, there's a lot of call and response singing that happens in the fields of work, right? And so that translated into the kind of like the religious side, if you will, of things. So yeah, I just grew up listening to, you know, these, and we would participate in, you know, people would kind of call out something and then the whole, you know, all the people would sing back. But just, in our kind of, group, I guess there was a group of women that were like just very good musicians, and with beautiful voices. And so I just really learned to appreciate kind of the harmony of women singing. And it's still kind of, people ask me like what my favorite music is. It's like, it's a lot of bluegrass, but it's a lot of, like the Be Good Tanyas and, you know, just all these women that sing, in harmony, like the Gillian Welches and, Yeah, all that stuff. So, yeah.
I'd like to know more about your Latvian roots, I think more broadly, too, because I don't know that I have met someone with those roots and with such a connection. You grew up in the Midwest, just like I did. You know, I didn't have exposure to a lot of different, say, religious or cultural backgrounds in a small town in northern Missouri. So I'm kind of curious if there's more of that connection for you and what you've learned and who you see that as, you know, who you are now, all these years later, if there still is that sort of deep-rooted connection.
Definitely. So Latvians are an interesting bunch. So for me, Latvian is my first language. So that's what I, you know, I didn't really get a firm grasp on English until I went to kindergarten. So I learned a lot of English from my brother and sister kind of as they came home from school. But we spoke Latvian in the house kind of exclusively. So Latvia is a very small country, right? So it is weird that you can be fourth generation Latvian now, like my friends who have kids, those kids speak Latvian as their first language here in the United States, which is peculiar compared to any other group of immigrants that have come into the United States, kind of from like, you know, Europe, Eastern Europe. Latvia is positioned in the world as a linchpin for being the most northern non-freezing ports to what is like from the Baltic to the Black Sea to the Atlantic. So it is a linchpin in all of Europe as a trade route. And so from as far back as history goes, somebody's tried to rule Latvia in order to control the trade route. And so for that whole time, Latvians have been fighting back to like hold, you know, our culture, you know, to not be kind of overtaken. Everybody, the Germans, the Mongols, like everyone has tried to come through there. So the Latvian language is also interesting because it has all these, you know, I'll hear words spoken from across the world, across the globe, and be like, oh, I know that word, right? And it's because at some point in time, some group of people came through Latvia and like we picked up that thing. Or like in the ancient kind of symbology, you'll see a lot of stuff like from India and, you know, kind of far off places that are not next to Latvia. And so, you know, fast forward throughout the years, right, whether it's Russian occupation or German occupation, Nazis, you name it, right, like we've been fighting back to hold on to our culture. And so my grandparents, when they showed up, they were essentially fled both Russian and Nazi occupation in Latvia. My mom was born in they called them DP camps, but displaced persons camps, which essentially is a refugee camp in Germany. Roundabout story. My grandmother walked herself as like a 15-year-old away from Latvia, roundabout way, ended up in Germany, met my grandfather, had a couple of kids, like years and years later, right? And then made their way over to the United States. They were sponsored by the Lutheran Church to show up in Michigan and work a farm, like indentured servants. And through all of that, my grandfather's whole plan was to one day go back to Latvia and like live in a free Latvia. He kind of got to do that. But that was the story of like most Latvians who came over kind of between 45 and 55, in the years 1945. And so we grew up in a Latvian culture in Michigan, going to Latvian school where we just learned, you know, language skills and history and all that stuff, to summer camp, to then to boarding high school every summer for 5 years, learning about kind of, you know, what it is to be Latvian and the history and language and literature and all that stuff, with the idea that someday we would go back, right? And that we would be Latvians in Latvia.
Was that the whole community you're saying, or not just your family?
Yeah, not just our family. Like in general, that was the idea. And so given you had people like my grandmother who was from the capital and she was a city gal. And like when she showed up finally in Michigan, like they didn't last very long on that farm because she was from the city, right? And she was like not having it like with outhouses and whatnot. So I think they worked like half their, you know, their their intended stay. And then the farmers were like, yeah, okay, you can just get out of here because this is not working. so they went out to Chicago, and then like she found her place and became this like really influential, you know, businesswoman, both in Chicago and then here in Denver. But she was a city gal. I mean, she was like a Chanel number five, kind of like, you know, big black rim glasses, like full on, you know, city gal. And obviously they parted, my grandfather and grandmother parted ways. But, yeah, my whole upbringing was this kind of like this duality of being, you know, an American kid and growing up in high school and whatnot. And then all of a sudden, like every summer I was in a boarding school in a, what we called, like, I'll call it the world's richest trailer park in Michigan, because Latvians are just per capita pretty, they're smart people who've become doctors and lawyers. And so they have this like camp essentially at the end of a lake in Michigan, in Three Rivers, Michigan, Podunk, Three Rivers, Michigan, where there's, you know, trailer park, kids camp, like everything is there. And so we grew up being this whole Latvian thing there, right? And it was in my generation where we really had to kind of come to terms with like, cool, you can go back to Latvia. Like, it's free. You can go back there and like start being Latvian there. And it's like, okay, well, do we want to? And I'd say probably a fifth of my friends, like, they live in Latvia now. They are doctors and lawyers and teachers and all the things there.
The ones that you grew up with.
Yeah. Like they live in Latvia now.
Have you had these conversations from a philosophical standpoint with those friends, if you're still in touch, to be like, okay, why are you choosing to go with what our parents and our grandparents and these generations, this vision they had, as opposed to staying where our whole lives have been?
Yeah, I mean, we had that, like, this is probably, I mean, this conversation happened probably 20 years ago when like they made these choices, but we had it back then. People made short movies about it, kind of like they did everything, right? Like at the time, because it was such a big conversation in our kind of general, you know, group of Latvians in America. And for me, it was like, for me, the outdoors were so important that, and the mountains were so important that I've been back to Latvia. We're actually going back to Latvia to do a bikepacking trip this summer, or like end of this summer, to kind of explore and share it with my wife and some friends. But the highest mountain in Latvia is, let's just say, it's not that tall. So it's just like, that whole portion of it just wasn't for me. So I definitely contemplated, you know, going back. But for me now, it's kind of this like deep personal, I don't even call it philosophical, I wouldn't call it religious, maybe like spiritual aspect of myself is like rooted in Latvianism, but maybe more so in kind of like in nature, and kind of what I learned from my grandparents. And
do you feel any conflict about that at this point, about the decision that you've made, but you also could change if you wanted, and what that connection to that history is in Latvia versus, okay, I'm a Latvian with this history that you've just spelled out, and I'm staying here in the U.S.
My conflict arises certainly in like in the ongoing notion that like Latvia is always on the brink of not being free, right? Because like Putin would love to do exactly what he's doing in Ukraine, in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, right? He would love to take the Baltics back and make it part of, you know, was like the Soviet Union. In that instance, I would go back in a heartbeat. Like I would go to war for Latvia, which I don't say lightly, you know?
Understood.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there was history either in Latvia or for Latvians of military service with such risks in mind. Did you have to make any commitment to Latvia at any point or feel a loyalty to that and then go over there and do any sort of, I guess, make a contribution, whether that's militarily or in some other form, with that in mind?
No, no.
Is there a military service component that is mandatory?
No. Nope. Yeah. I think that it's been talked about. I think maybe at certain times there was, but it's not now.
Even with what has happened to Ukraine and so on. Okay.
Yeah. I will say that there have been, just like a tangent of that, is that there have been a bunch of Latvian Americans who are Americans, right? Like they're kind of in that same grouping as me, but that went into the military and rose in the ranks of American military, and then have now made the, I don't know that they've made the switch, but they made it such that when Latvia became part of NATO, they made sure that the American military was positioning itself in places of power in Latvia in order to like build Latvian military strength with the help of America. So in the same sense that, you know, Latvian Americans became lawyers and doctors and whatever, like we've put ourselves in places of power in order to help Latvia become, you know, stronger. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you were growing up and it was such a community, like you described, was there any sort of perspective, like we are us, everybody else in America is them? Like, was there any sort of discussion of what was, say, who was acceptable to date or to have friendships with or to relate to in any sort of way that was outside of that community?
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of Latvian friends who married other Latvians. Like, there's a lot of that. Or if they married Americans, I don't know that it's like nobody was like, oh, you shouldn't do that. But I know a lot of those spouses that maybe weren't Latvian, they speak or understand Latvian now, which is crazy because Latvian's like, it's not a language worth knowing in the world, right? Like, there's 2.5 million Latvians in Latvia, and then like maybe another 500,000 Latvians in the rest of the world. Like, you're not gaining anything by learning this very complicated language. So Latvian comes off the Indo-European trunk, and it's like, it's unlike any other language. Lithuanian is like a little bit close, but like there's no other language. Like, it doesn't come, it's not like German or it's not like Italian, right? It's just its own little thing. So there's zero reason to really learn Latvian. But if you're going to be part of the Latvian community, you're going to learn a thing or two.
And it sounds like it benefits too. And that there's such a closeness and strength of community, which is what this sounds like.
Yeah.
All of that is born out of, as opposed to, say, a type of orthodoxy that is saying, no, 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 we are us, everybody else.
Yeah.
They, you know, it's vice. Don't go out there. It sounds more like it was about strength of community and your history.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds beautiful.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, it's, I'm glad to be Latvian, you know, for sure.
Let's talk about the mountains. And you mentioned those with Latvia and going back. And of course, here we live with a number of 14ers around us and in a state with so many. You are an athlete in a number of veins, and being out in the mountains as a skier or cycling and the different things that you do, rock climbing, kayak, like it's, I'm fascinated by this because I think you're kind of who I want to be when I grow up in that regard. You know, I grew up in the Midwest without mountains and without influence to do things like what you did when you went to Prescott, Arizona and went to study adventure education.
Yeah.
I had no idea such things existed when I was coming out of high school. I just stayed close to home. So tell me how you grew up with outdoors in your life and then would come to go to get that sort of education and pursue this outdoor and mountain life that you have.
Yeah. Boy Scouts, right? Like, as a kid, Boy Scouts, and then like a dad who hunted. And so we were just like in the woods a lot. Certainly a couple of different big Boy Scout trips, Latvian Boy Scouts. So not like the Boy Scouts of America, but we had scouting goes way back in Latvia as well. And our scout leader, like in Kalamazoo, Michigan, just happened to be like the leader of Latvian scouting in Latvia and America. So we just had this, you know, big connection to scouting, and we got to do some really cool, like kind of jamboree trips where we would go to New York, or we did one in New York, one to Canada, you know, where we get to like hang out with like 400 other Boy Scouts.
New York State or city?
New York State, like okay. The Catskills.
Just wanted to be clear because we're, you know, we're talking about outdoors, but then heading into the biggest city.
The Catskills. so scouting definitely was like a big part of it. And then, my mom, like my aunt lived out here in Colorado. So we did a couple of family like ski trips. We all piled into the car and drove 20 hours, you know, from Michigan to Colorado and went skiing. that definitely opened up my eyes to just like big, big mountains. I mean, I remember seeing the back bowls of Winter Park for the first time and skiing down in Powder. And it was just like, my mind was slightly terrified and blown at the same time. And then, yeah, I didn't really know about adventure education either, right? I like learned about rock climbing. We got a rock climbing gym in Kalamazoo, probably like somewhere in high school or maybe eighth grade or something like that. So I kind of, I learned about rock climbing and I was totally enthralled. And then lucky enough, I had a teacher, a English teacher in high school who, I mean, I was a terrible student when it came to education. But it just so happened that when I remember acing this exam on transcendental riders, I didn't actually have to like study for it because she asked the questions and I could just write kind of like from the heart about what I thought about their writing and how it related to nature. And it all just like made sense because given my background. So she kind of saw glimmers of hope in me. And at one point in time, she handed me a, back then they still had like books about colleges, right? And she handed me a book that was like all about Prescott College. And that was in my sophomore year of high school. And I like flipped through it and I was like, wow, this looks amazing. And then the back cover had the price and like the average GPA of students. And I looked at those two things and I was like, that's not going to happen, you know, but, yeah, fast forward, like, you know, 3 years or whatever, life changed a lot. And somebody asked me like, what in the world I really wanted to do with my life. And I thought about it for a second and I was like, oh yeah, Prescott College. That's what I want to go do. And like a year later I was there. So
when somebody asked you a question like that, when you were young, did you have influence or maybe it came from within you to believe, oh yeah, whatever I can think of, whatever I can dream, I can do that.
Yeah. The person who asked me that was a kind of like a personal development coach. And I was literally in the midst of doing a very big, personal development course. So I had had a, let's call it very large transition in being a terrible student to like somebody who actually gave a shit about what I wanted to be in life. So yeah, at that point in time, I was very empowered. And so it was like in a place of power that I was like, oh yeah, let's go do that thing.
That confidence feels extraordinary to me, maybe especially for somebody who is that young. Or maybe it's me talking through the filter of my own youth and not really feeling like anybody who said, oh, you can be whatever you want to be, it's like they didn't necessarily mean it or didn't. I didn't know what to do with that information and be able to feel that for myself. Convention, I guess, is what I felt strapped in by. And I just love that you took that opportunity. It seems to me a pretty pivotal point in your life as then you have moved forward professionally in various ways to an outdoor life and recreationally, personally.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was pivotal. It wouldn't have happened any other time before that. Let's say that. See, I'm glad I did the coursework and I'm glad glad she showed me the book and I'm glad I remembered it. So I could end up there.
I heard you say on a podcast with Travis Macy, who also is in the area, another incredible athlete that I admire and someone who's been on this podcast.
I cannot put myself in any category associated with Travis Macy. The guy's a beast.
You mentioned that you lived out of a van for several years. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm leaping here to assume that was when you were a rock climbing guide and things like that. Is that the case?
Yeah, totally.
So what was going on with that seven-ish year, I think, if you said on the other podcast, several years anyway, that period of your life, where were you living? What was that sort of sense of, I don't know, freedom, joy, fun, stress? What is that experience for you?
A lot of super fun work. Yeah, so I came out of Prescott College in Arizona and worked for a bunch of different programs. So a lot of private schools based in California, some guide services based in like Telluride Ophir. And just essentially went from contract to contract. I had a Grand Voyager, Plymouth Grand Voyager, you know, sliding two doors on both sides. And just drove that van around. And, you know, during the nice kind of like spring, summer, fall, I was living out of the van, and winters I would find a, you know, kind of a more permanent place to be. But even coursework in the winter, like, yeah, so I was bopping between essentially like Bellingham, Washington, Colorado, Arizona, and California on different courses. And then in between, I would just rock climb. So I climbed probably like, if I wasn't working, I was climbing. So a lot of years where I was climbing 300 days a year.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're a rock climber, that's kind of what you want to do.
So. Yeah. Well, again, that's a foreign idea to me. I mean, I had to get a hold of magazines probably not even until my 20s to realize that people were living those sorts of lives.
Yeah.
Like, it was just such a foreign idea to me.
Yeah, that like that dirtbag style of life, which I, you know, say that fondly, not like as to
right.
A lot of people will see that as like a I use that as a term of endearment. But yeah, I mean, it was fun. It also was super broke, right? Like, you didn't make a lot of money being teaching adventure education. Luckily, the prices have gone up a little bit, but I still think it's a pretty hard life to, it's a good life to lead when you're 20. But yeah.
That's the trade-off of that kind of life a lot of times, I think. And I think it's really good for us to keep that in mind. It's like, well, how sexy and amazing that person goes out and they just live so freely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, but the payoff there is that it is the freedom versus comfort versus food versus whatever you need in your life that as we get older, we tend to, you know, handle that equation differently.
Yeah, well, yeah, totally. Yeah. No, I'm not. I'm glad to not be there anymore. If I want to live out of the back of my truck, I still do sometimes. I that's the fun part is knowing that I can easily like go on a, you know, 2-week elk hunting trip and just like live out of a backpack and a truck with no problem. You talk to city dwellers and they're like, you didn't take a shower for 2 weeks? And you're like, yeah, no, whatever. It's all good. And they're like, they can't fathom. Right. And it's like, I have no problem strapping on my boots every morning and going to walk the mountains, looking for elk these days or something like that. Right.
Right.
It's a good life skill, I think, to have of this, like, there's a lot of people are like, oh, there's a lot of people, everyone's so soft, right? And it's like, there is a lot of city-dwelling creature comforts that people, like, can't get away from. And it's nice to know that you can go do hard things in the mountains still without some of that stuff.
And maybe even get to where you don't have connection, even if you wanted to turn on your smartphone.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, to know you got to deal with whatever happens on your own. Yeah.
It sounds like a really formative period in your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's also like it was probably throughout the majority of your 20s.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember exactly what year I settled down with my first wife, but yeah.
Well, I was just going to ask if there was a time where you remember, maybe it was just a conversation with yourself and you're like, I think it's time I grow up, whatever that means. It's time that I move into some different phase of life.
It wasn't that. It was just like, if you want to be like together with a person who has a child and like, you know, you got to take care of stuff and actually live in a house, you have to make more money. So then you don't get to live in a van. You got to go pay mortgage and all that kind of stuff. So yeah.
Yeah.
Life shifts.
You would end up moving to Colorado. As I understand it, cycling was part of that for you. Professional, amateur, the pro-am, what, cycling tour? What are we saying here? What are we describing?
Yeah, I mean,
talk about that competition piece.
It was, we raced against pros. We didn't get paid. We didn't have to pay a lot for it. So I got into cycling, kind of moved up the ranks really quickly. And then when we moved to Boulder, Louisville, I ended up joining a team and ultimately ended up like running the pro 1-2 category part of that team. So we got a bunch of sponsorship from Lucky Pie Pizza, which is a great pizza place that's like all over the Front Range. You know, we would put on a race, so we got like free bikes, we got free kits, a lot of free race entries stuff. We kind of traveled to various places in the United States to race bikes. I was never like in the pro category. I was still always like a 2 category rider, but we had a bunch of guys that were 1s and we were semi-competitive kind of in those regional races. So it was fun.
What did you learn about competing against people who were professionals?
A lot of them are on drugs.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. We've actually,
I say that jokingly, but I mean, I think in reality, there was still a lot of that stuff going on.
Sure. Yeah. I think also not jokingly. Right.
Yeah.
And I'll cite another guest we've had on this podcast, Joe Parkin. I don't know if you know him. And we talked about that. Now, in his day, it was going to Europe in cycling.
Oh, yeah.
And this was decades ago at this point. But, yeah, it's a thing. And
did he write a book?
He did. He's written a couple. A Dog in a Hat was his first memoir. And that is...
You had him on the podcast.
Yeah.
He sat in this seat. I'm like, wow. So that book was like pivotal to me racing bikes.
And I think for a lot of people, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very notable memoir from that experience.
Yeah.
But my point in bringing him up is that, yeah, cycling and enhancements are, there's a long history.
Yeah.
And so I think from that perspective, you're not joking. Like, yeah. It's true.
Yeah. I don't know that we saw necessarily a lot of it. There was some of that stuff going around when we were racing. But yeah, it's a good... Being in community for me is always and continues to be really important. And so having a team that we could, rely on was always a lot of fun. And just like, the weekend rides, right? Like you would spend essentially Saturday and Sunday and maybe some weekend evenings riding with, all your buddies. So it was a good time.
Community is a key word. Here, this is a community building podcast. The point is that we get to know each other in a richer way, and we maybe even break down some barriers to some things. And I know that it matters to you. And so, as I like to ask the occasional guest, what does community mean to you? And you've already touched on some of that from the Latvian upbringing, which is wonderful. Is there more that you would like to add in terms of what that means to you in your life, maybe now at this stage that you're in your early 40s?
It's important for me kind of in a trilogy of things. And so this is part of my last business. And I think it goes on now being something that just rings true for, I think, every human on the planet, is kind of as broad as I'll go, is that not only community, but real food, having a connection to real food and nature, right? Those are... and really, these are not my words. It's from a guy that I met randomly in that previous work that connected with me and wanted to know kind of why hunting was so important and why we based our brand off the kind of the things that we did. And I didn't have a lot of data to support this, but he actually was a data scientist and worked for a giant brand that I won't name. But they were doing kind of like deep dives on how to launch new product in the world. They're like a world-renowned brand. And he somehow found me. And we had this real like 4-hour long conversation twice. And what he told me essentially was that they had found the world over. It didn't matter if you were in, Moscow, Russia, or in Bangkok, or in, Nebraska. In one way or another, people would always come back down to the three things they want more in life is community, real food, and nature. And in places where people don't even have nature. So I think it was Bangkok, where people literally live in a 100-story building. They're surrounded by concrete. There is no green space around them. They had this idea that they wanted this like ethereal idea of nature. They would talk about it kind of in weird ways, but they wanted more of these real things, in which they then like kind of ultimately they were able to kind of put it in the box of, okay, it's actually nature that they want more of. Those three things are like crucial to our existence. And so I'm a firm believer that if we need to cultivate all of those three things in life, we'll have a better life if we do. So community, it's just like it's part of that three-legged stool, if you will.
What do you find in your relationship to nature personally, whether that's emotional, mental, there's the physical piece we're talking about some.
Sanity.
Quiet.
Yeah, I mean, like the beauty, like the actual like essence of beauty is just in nature. Like the algorithm is real in nature, right? It just it exists there in this certain way that you're like, why is it so beautiful? And you're like, oh, well, because it just is. Beauty, quiet, like, you don't have the phone chiming at you. You don't, like, you get to be an observer and know that you're all part of it. Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder about the abundance that we have where we are in Colorado, because we're so surrounded by it, and we can walk from, many of us can walk from our front door and get to a trail in a matter of minutes without necessarily even using a vehicle.
Yeah.
Compared to when, you know, I think we've both lived in cities, and it's, you might have to go to real effort to get out to that, and what that different feel is in the body or spirit, mind, whatever, when you're having to live in such, maybe an anxious way, in a city environment, you don't even realize you're yearning for nature, maybe. And here we're just surrounded by it, and it's so readily available. And just what that factors into our lives.
Yeah, you'd hope people be a little bit more relaxed here, which I think they are. It's like people probably say it's like a little more laid back here than it is in Denver.
People take a little longer to respond to emails.
Yeah, yeah, rightfully so. And even in Denver, right, like there's open space everywhere compared to other big cities, I think, across the United States. So I think we're lucky in general in Colorado that there's just – or that you can drive to the top. You can be in the middle of Denver, right? And if you drive to the top of the right hill, you can look a bunch of different directions and see snow-capped mountains, right? Like that does something for you to see that grandeur, right, in the world. Whereas if you're in the middle of Nebraska and the highest point is like 10 feet higher than you for the next 300 miles, like, sure, you might get like a big blue sky or a big open field, but like, is it the same? I would argue that it's not. There's something about that like scale that we get to see all the time. That's important.
In our house, we really try to not take it for granted.
Yeah.
You know, to just know that this is special and not to forget just because we live it on a daily basis.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I said it to my wife this morning. I say it all the time, right? When we're like, because we do split our time between Denver and Salida, the trail community and the trail building community and just the amazing work, the amazing boon that having such a dialed in trail organization gives to Salida, like it is worth its weight in gold, right? To like, now there's like a, if there wasn't already enough trails on S Mountain, if you know, you can choose from the 10 mile loop to the 7 mile loop to the 3 mile loop. And it's like, cool. Now there's a 5.5 mile loop because of the trail that's opening tomorrow. The Maybe Trail. And it's like that is amazing that we have that here. We're all better off for it to just have so much available to us. Yeah.
Let's talk about photography now.
Sweet.
I feel like it is almost cliche that photographers will ask other photographers, or maybe it's just anybody asks a photographer, how did you get started? What was your first camera? And with you, I think I already know that your first camera came through scouting. You mm-hmm. won it somehow. Mm-hmm. You were 9 years old, a neon pink Fuji. Mm-hmm. First of all, how did you win it?
They gave all of us, so there was like, I think some 400-500 kids, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts at this camp, right? They gave every single kid a disposable Kodak, wind up, point and shoot.
Okay.
What year was this? This is like, I don't know, like 92 or something like that. So we got to take pictures all week. And then they somehow, before the week was out, they had all the cameras processed. They looked through, 500 by 24 kids, whatever, that's a lot. They looked through all the pictures and they picked one girl and one boy that was like the best overall picture. And that's like, those kids won the camera. And I had taken this picture. I tried to find it a couple of years ago to see if someone could actually locate the actual picture for me. And I never did find it, but I still know the picture in my mind's eye. It's this kid like coming out in his dress blues out of a blue tent. And he's just popping his head and like upper body out of the tent. like ready to go to like the big kind of morning, you know, flag raising ceremony. And yeah, for whatever reason, that picture won.
Was that the first time you had ever had your hands on any kind of camera, even this disposable one? Like the first you were getting to explore and be like, okay, whatever I want to photograph.
Yeah, I think so.
So your first camera prior to the Fuji is this disposable.
Yeah.
And then you win your first competition, so to speak, and get your first, say,
I mean,
real
I was blown
camera.
Away that like it was like winning the lottery, the fact that I won the camera, right? Like I
sure.
had no idea it was coming. Yeah.
Well, I mean, as kids, I remember one of the best things I ever won in my life was a duffel bag at a basketball camp, right? It's such a cheap thing that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And yet, as a little kid, to have won that, it means something.
Yeah.
And for you, you are now a professional photographer, and you've had many years of this. So there was sort of a seminal moment, maybe, with that.
Mm-hmm.
Did that plant a seed that stuck with you, or is it just kind of the memory going back to it where you're like, oh, wow, now I see maybe something that I didn't know at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like, there's certainly when I won the camera, and I think maybe I shot pictures for a little bit of time with that thing. Like, there's definitely, it's not until I get to high school where I get another film camera and I start shooting for the high school paper and become like the associate or assistant photo editor or whatever for the paper, that I was like taking pictures of my friends, and a lot of them had really cool cars. So, you know, it was like doing that stuff. For whatever reason, I think at that point though, I always got the, oh, you have the eye, right? People would just say like, oh, that picture, like you have the eye for taking pictures. So that kind of stuck with me. Cause obviously I had the eye as a 9-year-old to like snap that picture. Not knowing, you know, the rule of thirds or anything, like not knowing the actual reasons why it was a good picture.
Right.
But I had the aesthetic for it to some degree.
Some sort of understanding.
Yeah.
Of what would make it visibly pleasing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then high school came and went, and then, you know, it's definitely come and gone over the years. And it wasn't until after, like I said, in the end of my college days, like for my big kind of senior thesis, I was shooting pictures outside of the work I was doing with kids and, you know, rock climbing and all that kind of stuff. So it slowly started to come back. And then that was right at the transition into like the digital world. So I remember taking on a bunch of credit card debt to buy my first digital camera, which is hilarious because I think it was such a piece of junk, but it cost like $1,000 back then when I was, you know, I'd make $1,000 in like a contract if I was lucky, you know? So so got into the digital world, and I think I took probably in the last 15 years I've probably taken 3 stabs at being a like professional photographer, and really only I guess it's kind of worked over the last maybe 10, but this last stint here, now that I've switched into what I'm doing now, just in the last 3 months, has really been like the where I'm like, okay, I can like really call myself a professional photographer that makes a living at what I do.
Is that when you transitioned into headshot or portrait photography?
Yep.
Was it adventure photography before that?
Yeah.
So are we talking, I think, running, skiing, things out in the mountains?
Yeah, kind of commercial advertising for adventure sports companies or sports brands, yeah.
I would imagine for people from the outside of that, it's almost like looking at National Geographic and thinking, wow, you're doing these amazing things where you travel the world, you go into these special places. Like, I mean, again, we don't want to take for granted we live in the mountains.
Yeah.
This might be nearby to you now, but you have it here. And for everybody who's not living in the mountains, that's pretty special. What's the reality of that kind of effort to make a living as an adventure or commercial photographer with brands like that, that people probably don't expect?
There are a ton of kids who, you know, trustafarian kids that will get cameras given to them by their parents, and then they'll work for cheap. So cheap that there's no way that they actually, you know, do that as their primary way of like paying the mortgage, right? Because they're living out of a van that their parents bought for them as well. I think in general, like 15 years ago, the outdoor industry was a totally different beast, right? Like the outdoor retailer was a huge show in Salt Lake that occupied the entire main floor of like the biggest room right at the Salt Palace. Now the Outdoor Retailer Show is essentially like in a small little room, and they can't even fill up that small little like auxiliary room, right? So the outdoor industry has changed drastically in the last 15 years. So have budgets. So have just like the way people operate with all of that stuff. So, you know, I've had good clients over the years. I had some fun doing that work, but it was never enough to like actually earn a living, which is why when like 10 years ago, when I had the split of, should I be a photographer or should I, you know, start this brand and do this whole thing with the, with my last brand, I chose the brand because I really thought that at the end that would make me a lot more money. So photography was kind of just on the sidelines for all of that.
My wife and I got started in photojournalism. That's actually where we met, was graduate school, as photographers, and then we're working freelance for magazines and newspapers and things in that capacity for a while. It did not take me very long to get tired of having to have the budget conversations, the rights conversations, and to become really aware that there's always somebody, especially it seems like with photography, but I think it's in all creative fields, that they will work for nothing, mm-hmm. whatever the reasons. And you mentioned some of those there, but they're so happy to be published or to be chosen or what have you, yeah. and they're not making a living. It's a really challenging field, I think, to get into. And yeah. so people can see your beautiful images on your website and think, wow, how amazing, that's your life. You're like, but it's so hard.
Right. Well, and it's not all your life, right? You've got to be working as a bartender, as a waiter, or something else to actually pay the bills. I mean, even back then, right, there was, all these magazines existed, right? There was Powder Magazine, there was Backpacker and Runner's World. Like, there was all these things, right? So if you're really good across a bunch of genres, but like one of those magazine covers pays like $1,500. Maybe there's 20 magazines. Like, do you think you're going to get on the cover of every magazine every month? Like, not even close, right? And like inside the magazine, those pictures aren't paying anything. So yeah, just the reality of what people, you know, sure, if you've got Nike as a brand that's paying you, absolutely. There's people in right now who make $10,000 a day working, doing that work. That's great. But like, those brands are few and far between. And when you get to that level, those photographers are few and far between. There's just like, it's not that many. So yeah, it's the reality of being a commercial photographer is just not, it's not all rainbows and summits.
Did you, as a kid, or whenever you were younger and thinking about photography, did you look at things like National Geographic or a climbing magazine or whatever and think, kind of like what we're talking about, somebody who doesn't yet know what the experience really entails, did you think, man, that's my dream? That's what I would love to do someday, is travel the world doing this?
Nope.
Nope? You didn't have any of those sorts of dreamy inspirations?
No. We were a family that had a whole, we had two bookshelves full of National Geographics. I don't know, like, we were subscribers, right? So we had every single one showed up. And I remember like always leafing through them and like, you know, doing school research projects like out of like all of the National Geographics. But no, I never had the idea of like, oh, I should do this for a living. The adventure stuff was always like my kind of passion, you know, calling for all those years was to go be an educator and to be like out using the natural world as a place to teach self-sufficiency and all the great things that nature has to teach. Yeah.
I did not anticipate getting into a technology talk because it's not normally where I go with anybody because it's not in my realm. But it just occurred to me, we're living in this, what now seems like an emerging scary mystery of AI, artificial intelligence, as that pertains to music and to the rights of artists who are out there, and of course to images, video, photography. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on that? And are you glad that you're no longer trying to compete with yet further cheaper options in terms of adventure photography?
Well, yeah, yes, I have lots of thoughts on it. I use AI in my editing software a lot. Like, it makes it easier for me to do retouching of images, significantly easier. I'm glad I know how to use those tools. That all being said, like, I don't think that Like if you try to have a headshot where you're like, you give it 10 pictures of yourself and it composites into like your new headshot, which is something that they offer, it's not good. Like you know, you can waste your money on it, but like I'll know immediately if I see it on your LinkedIn profile that like that's what you did, and I will think less of you as a professional that you tried to get away with that, because it's just not good, right? And so or if you try to like build an ad out of AI, like a lot of it's really garbage still. Like the person has six fingers or whatever, right, or like three eyebrows. And there are, you know, people are doing some things better, but it's still far off from that. And so like, is it a tool that we need to learn how to use? For sure. Like if you're writing your resume or anything like that, right? Like you should use ChatGPT to like do it quicker. We are all going to progress and do things faster because of it, but I don't think it's going to automate us out of the equation. Like it's like garbage in, garbage out, right? So you have to give it good information in to actually get good information out. And it shows every single time, right?
I've played around with the generative AI pieces for images of various kinds, and yeah, the six fingers and the weird things that it's doing at this point. But we also know there are better apps out there, and that it's progressing. I think you touch on some interesting points with the fact that probably to the masses of the population, AI seems like this one idea. Is it good? Is it bad? And there are these different components. And I think learning to use it as a tool is important. And there's a lot of learning for a lot of us to do about where the negatives might be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just all one or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as like my copyrighted images go, yeah, certainly like, you know, if I sell somebody a headshot, it's in my contract that, you know, you're not allowed to input that thing into an AI software.
Wow.
Because it's my copyright.
Like, yeah.
I created that thing.
That makes sense, but it never occurred to me until you just said it that, okay, now this is another new phase in your line of work or any creative line of work that you have to make these stipulations in contracts.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's the important part, right, is that we're not giving these companies all this information for free, because that information is years worth of learning and doing and, you know, understanding that we create all the information that it gets for free. Like, that's not fair.
Yeah. Let's maybe wind down with this. I'm curious, with so much experience, even though you are only in your early 40s and there are decades still of adventures ahead for you, I'm curious what you feel like you have learned maybe about life to this point. Maybe that's through some trials and tribulations where you learn something specific, or maybe it's more general and you're thinking, you know what, this is what I've come to is, you know, some point of spiritual maturity that now is your focus or purpose in life. You know, however you might take that ranging question.
Alcohol is not a performance enhancer.
So many of us have figured that out, or in the midst of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a huge part for me in the last year is like, you know, at 41 or up until 41, I feel like I've done some pretty fun and exciting things. And the next 40 years, I'm going to do it all sober, because I don't think that all that stuff is a performance enhancer. And so I hope that my adventures and my dealings can be even more amazing without that stuff, which this last year has proven to like already be. I'm already on track for that, so I'm excited about it.
Has that been enough to make it easy, or quote easy, or is it still pretty challenging despite knowing, wow, I'm better off, but I feel the pull?
I will say that I am an addict, and so I have the innate ability to simply be addicted to the next thing or to not doing it, right? So like now that I'm sober, I'm like, I don't even have a second thought of, oh, I want to, you know, smoke some weed, or I want to have a beer. Like, yeah, I just on to the next.
What is next? What is the thing now, or the next that's
Not doing it is the next thing, right? It's like the, some people might say, well, that's not a thing, but it's like, yeah, I just like, don't use substances, which is like, I'm addicted to like my stretch, right? Going to 40 years of like, I'm going to be sober for 40 years and that's the goal. And it just ultimately gives me like, I can tap into my like emotional state, right? I can like get angry and then like understand that I'm just angry and, you know, work through my emotions, things like that, right? Whether it's road rage or, you know, having a conversation with my wife or whatever, it's just like, being way more clear eyed, being sober is just like, gives you the opportunity to kind of see all of life more clearly, and dial it in a little bit more. So,
yeah,
again, it's not a performance enhancer. So I'm still at 42 looking for every performance enhancer, whether it's learning how to ride my dirt bike better or learning how to run ultramarathons better or, you know, ski better. I still want to get better at all of those things. And doing it sober, you definitely get better. I don't know. Otherwise, we can do hard things. That's like a big mantra of ours, right? When we're doing ultra running. I just completed the Grand Traverse, or this year it was the Grand Reverse. So we went from Crested Butte to Crested Butte, over the 50K ski race.
Do you have any ideas of doing the running version in summer?
Not right now. I was supposed to do it years ago and I couldn't because I got injured. It's just not like I've got another, the High Lonesome is really big on my list of races to do. So this year I'm going to help out with photography. And then hopefully next year I'll have enough points and kind of stuff in the lottery. So hopefully run that next year. But,
You've got a lot going on. And, I'll circle back to what I said at the beginning. So many fascinating things that I think that you're into and capable of. So it's really cool to get to talk with you, Mateng. I just want to say thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, it's great being here.
Thanks for listening to the We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast. If our conversation here today sparks curiosity for you, you can learn more in this episode's show notes at wearechafee.org. If you have comments or know someone in Chafee County, Colorado, who I should consider talking with on the podcast, you can email us at info@wearechafee.org. We invite you to rate and review the We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use with that functionality. We also invite you to tell others about the Looking Upstream podcast. Help us to keep growing community and connection through conversation. Once again, I'm Adam Williams, host, producer, and photographer. John Prey is engineer and producer. Thank you to KHEN 106.9 FM, our community radio partner in Salida, Colorado. To Heather Gorby for graphic and web design. To Andrea Carlstrom, director of Chafee County Public Health and Environment. And to Lisa Martin, community advocacy coordinator for the We Are Chafee Storytelling Initiative. The We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast is a collaboration with the Chafee County Department of Public Health and the Chafee Housing Authority, and it's supported by the Colorado Public Health and Environment Office of Health Disparities. You can learn more about the Looking Upstream podcast and related storytelling initiatives at wearechafee.org and on Instagram and Facebook at We Are Chafee. Lastly, until the next episode, as we say here at We Are Chafee, share stories, make change.